Hello, everyone. I'm Dominique.
And I'm Christina, and we are the Connected in Glass podcast.
Every week, we will feature interviews with glass artists who speak to their creative processes and overcoming challenges.
These conversations are real and raw. We hope that by sharing these stories, you're able to find some connection and know that you're not alone.
We just wanted to take a moment to thank you for listening to our podcast. We're super passionate about this project and work for hours every week to bring you this content. So if you'd like to help support us, please consider becoming a patron at patreon.com/connectedinglass. Also, please consider joining our Facebook group, Connected in Glass Community, where we continue the conversations from these episodes. We'd love to hear from you.
This episode of Connected in Glass is sponsored by DiddyClips. DiddyClips has changed the way we film our glassblowing videos, and we're proud to be working with them. Today, we're interviewing Erin Lehman. Erin is a glass artist from Dracut, Massachusetts, who began blowing glass in 2001 at the age of 16.
Hello.
Hi.
Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
All right, so we're going to jump right in and we want to know all about you. First, skip the glass part of your life from now. Maybe just tell us about yourself, where you live, what you enjoy besides glass, and kind of work us into your story about glass.
Sounds great. So where I live currently is Dracut, Massachusetts. I live there because I ended up building my studio in Lowell, and Dracut's right next door to Lowell, so that's where I purchased a house and been raising my family. I'm originally from Gloucester, Mass, right on the ocean. This is where I grew up, where I consider myself from, where my roots are, where a lot of my friends are still from. And I love, you know, just being on the ocean and that close. But I have two little boys, Luca and Leon, and my wife, Maria. And we live in Dracut and have a little yard we like to play in constantly. We camp in the backyard. There's a lake down the street, which is nice. We go canoeing and kayaking there, play down there. I try to go to the beach as much as possible. What else would you like to know?
All right, let's work into glass and then we can see how it integrates with the rest of your life a little bit. So you started glass when you were 16.
Yes, how? I started blowing glass in someone's backyard in Hamilton, Massachusetts. So I grew up in Gloucester. I went to high school in Hamilton, and I had an interest in glass blowing from an early age. I used to watch at Simon Pierce, Queechy Gorge. So I would go there and just kind of, I feel like a lot of glass blowers from this area in my age group saw glass there for the first time and were mesmerized. So that's where I saw glass and kind of fell in love with watching it. And then when I was older in high school, I needed to do an internship. And I also had an interest in glass blowing. And I looked for different classes in different areas and couldn't really find a whole lot. And was speaking to someone, and someone's cousin had a glass blowing studio in their backyard. So I called him up and ended up going there. And it was really a great spot and did an internship, took a few lessons, and fell in love with the material, and which I still am today. And that was, when I was 16, just kind of roaming around, you know, high school kid falling in love with glass and getting really hooked.
And this was all hot shop glass, right?
Yeah. So what he did for the most part, well, he was all over the place, but it was more of a sculptural approach to glass, where he was doing a lot of hot sculpting out of solid glass. That was kind of his passion at the time, sculpting a lot of figurative work and some animals, things like that. And then we were doing a little bit of lighting as well. But he had a really wild style, and I learned a lot. Like one of the first projects, we were blowing into this huge, it was actually out of plywood, which is horrible, but plywood mold. It was smoking up like crazy. And they're like paper bag sized pieces. They kind of looked like colorful paper bags. That was one of the first introductions. So it was very loose in that way with form, again, a little more sculptural than, you know, trying to make perfect cups or things like that. And I feel like that stuck with me a little bit.
And did you know right away, like, this is what I'm going to do forever? Or were you just kind of doing it because you needed an internship and you thought it was interesting?
No, I mean, I pursued it more so because I wanted to do it. And then I feel like the internship kind of fell into place. And yeah, I did know that's what I wanted to do. And I followed that path. I wanted to be a marine biologist before that, like always when I was a kid, and sort of, and it's funny, my oldest son wants to be a marine biologist. Who knows, maybe he'll end up being a glass blower.
Oh, that's so funny how it goes around.
It's true.
Wait, okay, so then after that, tell us that about where you took it. By me, you didn't push it into him, but like, you're pushing him to be a glass blower, so.
No, not at all. No pressure.
Okay, then, so yeah. Then what did you do next?
From there, glass-wise, I went to Franklin Pierce College, which is kind of our mutual connection, and I ended up blowing glass there with Jordana, and she was a great teacher, and I feel like I unlearned a lot of bad habits, because when I was in the other place, I learned a lot, but it was also, you know, okay, go play in the shop. I actually started blowing glass when on the wrong side of the bench. I'm a lefty, and they're like, okay, blow glass, you know, however you want on this side. And then a few months into it, they're like, if you're serious about it, switch to the other side, which I did. But so, you know, that was still at the other spot. But then I started at Franklin Pierce, and, you know, I feel like I learned a bit more technical stuff there, you know, focus on cups a little more and vessel making in general. But then once, you know, I started to build skill, I started to visit more sculptural stuff as well. You know, I would do a lot of faces. I sculpted a lot of little heads. I did also figurative stuff. I was into sculpting the figure, which came from working with Mark. Mark Hursty was the guy that I started blowing glass with. So I still pursued that. And sometimes I'll still make a figure here and there. And then from Franklin Pierce, you know, I was there for 4 years, which is great. I was a TA in the studio. I had a key to the shop. And, you know, it was pretty free, which was the best part. Like, you didn't learn, like, if you went to a glass-specific school, you didn't really learn a whole lot about casting. You know, we did a little sand casting here and there. There wasn't a cold shop or anything like that. I don't know if it was like that when we were there.
Yeah, right, but on point.
Yeah, but with that being said, I had a key to the shop, and I would blow glass till midnight. You know, so that was, or wake up super early in the morning and blow glass before school started, and we had that freedom. Or I think we had it. At least I took it, you know, in, you know, a not abusing way, but we also took care of the studio. And so I got a lot of experimentation time, got to play and have fun. And I feel like I learned a lot that way.
It is amazing how much access you get to a studio when you're in college. And then sometimes you get out of college and you're like, what am I going to do now? So what did you do when you got out? Well, yeah,
great segue, by the way. So from there, you know, I was a glass blower. I studied arts management at Franklin Pierce. So it was half art, half business, essentially, with a nonprofit focus. And during that time period, actually, when I was at Pierce, I did another internship out at the Eugene Glass School. I know I'm kind of going backwards, but it, you know, it prompted that in my mind. So I would go out to Eugene in the summers, and through the guy that I worked with in high school originally, he actually went out to Italy and he worked with Pino Signoretto. And another guy came back with him from Italy, and we all, you know, blew glass together. And so I stayed in touch, and I ended up going out to Eugene where this other guy was and working at the Eugene Glass School. So I would go out there. I went out for a few summers. I did my business style internship there in college. And then after, I decided to move out west and I moved to Eugene. I worked for a few people in this area. Like, I worked in the Boston area at a few glass schools, and then, you know, ended up just packing up my car and driving to Eugene, Oregon, thinking I was kind of settling there. And out there, I was working production, which was great. You know, I would do like a 4-hour stint in the morning, go home, you know, super coffee shop culture, get a coffee, take a nap. And then I would work for someone else for 4 hours at night. You know, so it was just like, that was, it was a shift, you know, but like I had the day off and that was just what I was doing. And then I would make my own work here and there at the glass school. And I would volunteer there and trade for time. And that's kind of what I was doing there. I only stayed there for 9 months when I thought I was moving there. You know, I got an apartment. It was great. But then, you know, I met my wife, you know, which seems to like always uproot you when you fall in love, you know, and I ended up, not moving, but leaving there. She's from Argentina. I ended up going to Argentina for a while. And then back to Eugene and moving all my stuff out of there and coming back to Gloucester where I'm from. And then my wife coming here, you know, or my girlfriend at the time and, you know, that's a whole nother story that's not glass related.
Well, but so she doesn't have anything to do with glass. Does she like glass? Or
yeah,
she probably understands it a lot, right?
She gets it. You know, sometimes she wishes I wasn't thinking as much about glass, you know, as all of our partners probably are, you know, when it's like, what are you thinking about? Oh, nothing. Just like how to put that piece together or like how I could figure that out. But she's tried blowing glass a little bit. She was actually really into it. We have a couple kids and it was all, you know, she was getting more into it, you know, then kids come, then in between kids, and then there's two children and it makes it a little tricky because if I'm teaching her, there's no one to watch the kids. So it was hard to teach. I ended up having one of my students who I was essentially having learned how to teach my wife in between so I could watch the kids, but she would like to go back to it. I've had my children in there a few times playing with a gather, scaring us, you know, or I'm a little more free with them. They can run across the room with a gather or something, but you know, there's always a few sketchy moments.
That's so funny. Okay. Tell us about how you started your studio. Then did you just find, like, tell us about the journey to start your studio. You have a really nice electric furnace now, right?
I do,
pretty
yeah.
big one.
So when I came back from, or moved back here from Eugene, I started making, or I was doing a lot of glass work and I was primarily doing craft shows. There's kind of like a gap there in between starting my studio, like of quite a few years. But so I was doing a lot of craft shows. I was making my work in Boston and I was doing a lot of teaching as well. I've always taught, you know, since being a TA at Franklin Pierce, teaching has always been part of my income, something that I've really enjoyed doing. So I was teaching, making work, and selling work. To me, it was always important to sell stuff. And then I was also gaffing stuff for other people. And that was all kind of part of how I made my living. And which was great. It was working. Obviously, I wasn't making a ton of money, but I wasn't having a lot of expenses besides, you know, trying to blow glass, but it was all working out. And then, you know, I was selling more and more. And then again, gaffing for other people. A lot of like, I was working for a metal worker. I still do some work for him where I make glass parts for his sculptures. And that was going pretty well. And I decided that, well, I knew that I wanted to have my own shop, but sometimes it's hard to rent in other studios. There's a lot of personalities around, and I found a great deal on a bunch of equipment that I bought. So I had a bunch of equipment, and then I did a pretty big search for a studio. I looked into like trying to build like a metal building. I looked into a bunch of spots, and then I knew someone who was a glass blower. He rented at the same hot shop as me, but he was mostly a lamp worker. And he had a studio in Lowell at Western Avenue Studios. And so that's how I ended up over there. I actually started the studio with him. It didn't quite work out in terms of being partners, but he's still there. But that's what brought me to the studios. And so that's 5 full floors of artists. There's, let's see, like 275 studios, I believe, which is pretty crazy. People, all different mediums. There's actually a few lamp workers and fusers, the only hot shop there. And it's an incredible space.
Did you already know about running and managing a studio from your other experiences, or was that a learning curve for you when it came to like managing your own equipment and managing the business side of a studio?
So it was definitely a learning curve. I can build some things, but I'm not super, super technical. I do know how to ask for help when I need it. All my equipment was incredibly used, and I figured out how to rebuild and replace and whatnot. But I had some tech experience. You know, I plumbed glory holes. Out in Eugene, I was doing some teching, but I was never the lead guy on doing that. I was like hands and, you know, and thinking through and some ideas, you know, on how to do something more creatively, not how to do it exactly, you know, how it'd be to code. I think with having a glass studio, especially, you know, used equipment, you usually, or in my case, didn't know how to do a lot of it and you just figure it out. And then when something breaks, you just keep figuring it out. And, or, you know, you can call someone. There's a lot of good tech support out there too for talking you through how to fix a broken furnace or figure out what is the problem. You know, I have an incredible safety system. My studio took about 9 months to permit. I had to get a special use permit from the state of Massachusetts and get engineered drawings and plans and have them approved and disapproved and keep going down that route, which was really hard. And, you know, I paid people, I traded in glass, and I tried to do it as cheap as possible. They didn't like the original glory hole design, and, you know, I had to redo the whole safety system, which was quite difficult.
So can you tell us about your body of work now and also how you make your income? Because I think you make it in a bunch of different ways now too. And some of it is through like your sculptural body of work that you're pursuing. Mm-hmm. And then I think some of it's through some production stuff too.
Yeah, I'm happy to talk about that. So pre-COVID, it was very much dependent on teaching. So I was doing a lot of, I was doing make your owns. I was doing private lessons. I was doing some night classes. I've been doing a lot less of those since I had children, just because I'm trying to be home as much as I can. I was doing weekend workshops, but it was a lot of teaching. But what that gave me was the ability to pursue the sculptural stuff. So by doing so much teaching, even though really, like, I think 1 year I didn't make anything for myself besides some production work from September through December, I still had the ability, you know, moving forward in January or February to make more sculpture stuff without having that stress. And that was one way I was making an income. And before, when I was doing lots of craft shows, before I had a shop, or even at the beginning when I had my shop, when I was transitioning to doing more teaching, I was doing a lot of production. And that was lots of bowls, tons of paperweights, glasses, vases. So like kind of $100 to $500 vases. You know, it wasn't super high end. My production line was anywhere from $25 to $500. And that worked. I made a living doing that. And I sold a lot of it. I never heavily pursued wholesale. I've had a few wholesale accounts and I still have some, but gaffing those parts for that other artist kind of fulfilled that place of wholesale for me, where I didn't have to pursue that as much. And it was actually pretty interesting because a lot of it was different projects, but some that's sort of, again, faded away a little bit and comes back up here and there. The sculptural work is something I've been seriously pursuing for the last 4 years. I've always sculpted glass. I've always loved that. But I made the decision about 4 years ago, the slow decision, that I really want to make what I want to make. Meaning, like, I don't want to make something catered to the market, or I want to sculpt and I want people to like it. I know these are a lot of wants, and that's why it's super slow to happen. But I've pursued that path. Like, if other people do it, why can't I? So I've taken that approach. And every year I'm selling more and more of the sculptural work And it's actually, you know, I'm selling a fair amount of it. I can't make a living just doing that, but I hope to, in a year or two, I'll still do some production here and there. I'll still do some other jobs if they come across. Like, award jobs are always great. If you can get an award job, it's like, make me 100 of these things for almost retail price is great. But the sculptural work is my passion, and that's really all I want to make. And that's somewhat of a problem sometimes. But with that being said, if it starts to sell, it's a good thing. But right now, my problem is not having enough of it, because I need to get it out to more galleries. I need more stuff completed. Completing sculptures takes a while.
How do you work through that design phase of making those sculptures? Do you draw it out? Are you one of those, like, in your brain envision type people, or how do you work through that?
It depends on what I'm making and who I'm working with. My focus right now and the form that I've been making is mostly bird based, and they're mostly like heron or egret, kind of long, beautiful necks. You know, it's a sexy shape out of glass. You know, there's a lot of curves. It goes from narrow to bold and then narrow again. It's a nice shape, and it's difficult. With that shape, sometimes I'll draw it, but it's ingrained in me. And I'm not someone who's going for perfection. I'm going for like a suggestive form or the feeling of something. But if I'm making a piece that I've never made before or a different shape, I'll draw it out, but I'll draw it less as like a finished piece and more as like a step. I'm puntying here, or I'm making a donut in the glass, and then I'm cutting that donut open and then spreading it. But with that being said, if I'm working with someone I've never worked with before or just a few times, I draw it out a lot more so that we're on the same page. Like if I'm working with assistants that I've worked with before for many years, we don't even have to speak. You know, it's mostly hand motions and, you know, like some grunts and a joke. You know, it's less about, you know, the work in that way. I will draw pictures. I enjoy drawing, and I'll think through color schemes more with drawings opposed to the sculpture.
So can you talk about your color and the techniques that you're applying within the sculptures too?
Yeah. So for me, you know, the form is beautiful, and then there's a lot of color work, and I've dedicated a lot of time to how I color glass. And sometimes it's just meant to look beautiful. Sometimes there's more of a meaning to it. Like there's a piece that I just completed. And I've started doing a little bit of carving into pieces more, which you can develop story more with, I feel like. So one, for example, like I've rolled up, or I'll start in layers with the glass. So this piece is supposed to represent salt marsh, sandbars, rivers, and then opening and tides, right? So if I have a base color of some sort of blue, and then I'll do wraps. I use a lot of threaded wraps, and DuroColor is great stuff, Gaffer Duro. And I'll use that because the lines stay really strong and true, and you can push it around and twist it and do whatever you want to it. Generally, if you use enough of it, it stays really nice. So let's say I have a base color, some clear on top. I'll do some threaded wraps. And then I'll usually push those around to make them more interesting. So for that particular piece and this whole series that I've been going through, the current series, so I'm trying to make those lines look like current lines. So the current going in, going out, so the movement of a tide. So that's what those lines are suggesting. And then this particular piece that I'm talking about, on top of that, I'll do, you know, more clear, and then I'll put like a sand color. So it's a frit that looks like sand. And then on top of that, I have different colored green canes, cut at different sizes, and I'll roll those up onto the surface. And then that kind of is representing marsh grass. So I made a bunch of pieces like that. And then one recently I carved. So I did that, and then I carved rivers throughout it, carving through those canes and that sand color, carving pretty deep because it was really thick. And I was using a sandblaster and a Dremel, and that, you know, carved through the marsh, you know, making those tidal rivers. So I can tell a story, you know, with the bird form, but also tying it to place. And that same sort of thing with those current lines, since these all actually, this color series is during the pandemic, with the current lines going in and out. And then I use a lot of shards in my work, which is lots of people use shards. I try to use them in my own way if I can, where I, in these particular pieces, I'm actually using thicker shards and crushing them up and putting them on that bottom half. And I feel like it grounds it and almost makes it look like earth or coastline or something like that. So that's just a few, you know, like color schemes.
And you mentioned before that finishing sculptures takes a lot. So clearly, like, each sculpture takes like a few hours in the hot shop, but then after that you have the cold working and you also have to figure out how to display them. Can you talk a little bit about that process for you, for yourself?
Yeah. So each bird is somewhere between, you know, probably 2 hours in the shop. If there's more color work, it can go faster. Sometimes I'll do prep. Some of the color stuff, I'll make color tubes. There's all these new pieces that I haven't finished yet are all with like hundreds of little lines in them of cane. So it's a lot of pulling cane, chopping them up, doing roll-ups, making tubes. I'll chop those tubes up, anneal them, and then that way it's not all that long in terms of making the piece. So you have half the piece done. You know, there's 40 minutes of color work, you know, in that step, and then you can pick it up and you're halfway there.
So then say a bird comes out of the annealer, right? Talk about that rest of the process, like any cold working you did, and also how you display it, because you have like metal and you have wood, and how you consider going through all of that.
In terms of finishing it after the hot shot, my first step is I have these on big blow punties. So I need to chop away a lot of that punty. So I actually will hold it and I'll use different cane nippers and whatnot and just kind of chop away at it. And then what I do is I actually fill them with argon gas and I seal it with Hextall and a stringer that's sized to the size of the hole. I drill a little hole with tungsten inside of it when in the hot shop before I put the blow punty on there. And what the argon does is it displaces the oxygen. And so when you're sealing it, there's no chance or very little chance of having any condensation. Because if you didn't displace that oxygen and you filled it, or you didn't fill it rather, there would be a chance of condensation at some point. And I use transparent colors. I like opaques, but generally speaking, my work is all transparent. That's just one of the things I love about glass, which in some ways makes it more difficult because it has to be ultra clean. And if there was condensation inside, you would see it, but I'm just obsessed with transparent and can't get off them, you know, and don't want to. So I seal them with Hextall, and that's a whole process in itself because you don't want it to run in. So I have this, you know, I fill it, I flip it so it's face down, like what I'm doing, and I have boxes out in my studio with all these birds face down in them. And then I'll wait about 12 hours because Hextall takes a while to cure, and I'll flip it back the other way. So it, you know, it fills back a little bit. It's moving very, very slowly at that point, but I'll then put more Hextall on it so it kind of soaks into the piece more at that point. Maybe it does nothing, but maybe it does. It seals it a little bit more. And then from there, they're sealed, but I actually don't do my cold working. I have someone named Tomo. You may know her. She's one of the best cold workers out there. So I drive my work to her shop, and every once in a while I'll work with her, but mostly she just cold works those punties off. So she'll grind away those punties for me. It's a little bit of a process. Some of the shards go away. Some of them, they don't. It's okay. And then if there's sandblasting, I generally will do the sandblasting if it's not just frosting. So like those carved pieces, that was like hours and hours of sandblasting to carve through, especially because I'm trying to dial in someone else's sandblaster. That's out in Worcester. I'm figuring out the best way to do that and to carve through and not blast through your piece and fix the machine of when it's broken and whatnot. So there's that whole process. Then I have the bird back. And I mentioned my building has 5 full floors of artists. There is a metal worker there. And I can weld, but I'm better with horrible welds, sticking my equipment together and casting over the welds, you know, things like that, or fixing a glory hole door. He does my welding for me. So I bring up the birds to his studio. He just moved, to which I'm on kind of like this holding pattern until he gets his shop up and going. And it's not his full-time job. It's like hobby job. So I kind of like secondary to his full-time work. It's very slow, but we'll trace out the birds, kind of figure out how they're going to be, how they're going to sit, you know, work with them in that. And then we'll create the stands, how they're going to hold it. It's important that it's minimal. So you don't want it to cover over pattern, or that the metal follows a line in the pattern to blend in. I am trying to figure out with some outdoor work, you know, if I crimp it in a little bit more. I've had a lot of requests for outdoor work that I'm still figuring out right now. And they're now stainless for that reason. So the stands, and I get them done extra tall, essentially, with more metal. And then I bring them back to my studio. And I really like doing them in pairs or sets of 3, things like that. And so I need to set them. But part of the process is going and finding the stones. And I found a quarry in North Chelmsford near where my studio is. And they let me go pick all their scrap piles. So I go a few days a year, and it's one of my favorite days out of the year. And I get to roam around this old quarry. It's 4th generation. So it's over 100 years old. There's rusting cranes, there's old cars everywhere, giant pieces of stone, and mountains of what they consider scrap, because it's, you know, usually cut on 1 or 2 sides in a weird way. And I'll just dig through there and find treasures. They probably think I'm a little crazy. And then I give them a big bag of glass, and I'm happy. So I have all these stones outside my studio, and I stare at the birds, stare at the stones for way too long, figure out what works. And then I need to mount them, and I drill them out with a hammer drill. I have a Bosch hammer drill, which goes through granite like butter. And I'll drill the holes, kind of ream them out. It's a little tricky because it's usually just me holding up like multiple birds in these stands, trying to see how they're going to fit and marking it, you know. And I'll do that, make it work somehow, figure out the spacing, drill it. And then I slowly cut the metal down to see exactly how they're going to space. Like I'll take a 1/2 inch or 1 inch off and then do that to the next one and, you know, figure out what sort of relationship I want to build by how they're interacting. Like if you have 2 birds, they're facing both out, you know, they could be looking at different things. They could be mad at each other. They could just, you know, be cuddling in a weird way. I don't know. You know, if they're facing each other, they could be in love, or they, you know, you can twist them in different ways. They could be brothers, sisters, you know. And I try to create those relationships. And then I don't want that to be front and center, because someone could see one thing. Like I had these pieces and I made them and I called them brothers to myself. And I said that to a client who was looking at the piece. He's like, well, I thought they were lovers. And I'm pretty sure I lost the sale, because he's like, I don't want to think about these as brothers. It's supposed to be me and my wife, you know? So that's one aspect. Anyway, so that's a little bit of a tangent. But from there,
yeah.
From there, I mount them in there. I use a PC-11 or PC-7, which is a marine grade epoxy. And I always get confused what one looks like granite. I think it's 11, PC-11. It's like a grayish color. And then if you sand it or cut away, it looks almost exactly like granite. So it blends really well. And at that point, the sculpture is done. And, you know, then it has to sell, which is the key, right, at the end there.
Right.
How you make more.
How, with all of that, how do you even, like, conceivably price that? What's your
Well, there's a lot of thought, right? And if you want to make sculpture as a living, you have to think through, okay, how many am I going to sell a year? And with how many of those that you're selling, you know, to make a living after your, you know, your cost. That's one equation, right? Like, if you're only going to sell 10 pieces a year, those 10 pieces have to be at least $10,000. Not that I'm pricing my work there, but that's like one easy example. But I feel like you need to be competitive. I look at other people's pricing. And also, I ask the galleries that I'm working with. Like, I have my ideas. And then I also ask people what their thoughts are on my pricing for the sculptural stuff. But there's a lot of thought that goes into that, a lot of research over years. I mean, I've been blowing glass for 20 years, and I've always looked up and kind of feel like I've always wanted to be making those sculptural works in the galleries that I want to work with and be in the collector's market, essentially. And so I've been looking at that pricing for years, and it changes. Right? And you don't want to put yourself with people who've been selling for a long time. You need to start somewhere, but at a place where your work can gain value. You know, like if someone's going to start collecting your work now, you know, it'd be nice for them to see the value of your work go up over the years, because they know they're, you know, it's about the piece. Then it's also nice to, like, see the value of the work that you have going up to an extent. You know, like, I don't think about that much, but when you're starting off at a base price point, you know that it's going to go up slightly, because for me, how, when my work goes up in price, it's usually it goes up because it was significantly more work, because you want to keep improving and pushing your technique. And usually with pushing your technique, it's hours more of color work, you know, like, well, yeah, it's just hours more of work to make that piece, or failures. And then you're not putting out a lot of the work as well. If something isn't very nice, you don't finish the sculpture. It just sits on the shelf, especially with that secondary work. You know, a lot of the time it will be cold work, but then it's like, well, this isn't very nice anymore, or this work is significantly better, so I'm not even going to finish that. And that's part of creating value to an extent.
Do you always feel strong and powerful with the direction that you head down, or do you ever second guess yourself? Do you wake up some mornings and just think, like, how am I doing this and why am I doing this? Or do you ever suffer from imposter syndrome, or do you feel pretty focused and pretty confident all the time?
First of all, I didn't know what imposter syndrome was. I've listened to a lot of your podcasts. I was like, well, an imposter, someone copying your work. You know, like, that's what your first, like, thought is. And then I looked it up because I need to know. And it's not that at all, right? I feel good about what I'm making because it's part of me. And I only put out my best work for my sculptural stuff, generally. You know, that's what I try to do. But, yeah, you always second guess yourself and question, like, okay, is it good enough for that? And, like, sometimes I find myself applying for different things and you don't get it always, or you talk with different galleries, it doesn't work out at first, but you keep trying. You know, part of doing this is getting rejected, but then you just keep asking. And I'm relatively persistent, not annoyingly, but I'm like a once a year, you know, like, I'm persistent enough. And I still keep applying to things. I'm not a strong writer. So when it comes to, like, writing about my work or doing things like that, that's where I second guess myself a lot more. Like, if it's an application to something, like, well, just applications for grants or for scholarships or, like, a show somewhere, like, writing about it is always a struggle for me. And like, maybe I'm just wired differently in terms of how I say things or whatnot. And that's what I question a lot. I don't necessarily question my work. But with that being said, if it's not selling, yeah, I definitely question it, because I can't just keep making it, because, you know, I have a family and a hot shop and expenses that everyone else in life has. And it's not that I just can make this work to feed my soul, because this is also my profession. So I, you know, I have to make money at it. I was the sole provider for my family for years. My wife's starting a new job on Monday. She's been home with the kids for the last 6 years. So again, I was doing a ton of teaching. And that's what allowed me to pursue this, even if it wasn't selling that fast, because my income stream was there. And, you know, I was selling, you know, 4 or 5 sculptures a year, but in reality, you need to sell 15. And I'm not quite there yet, but I'm trying. And you figure out, you know, I have all these equations in my head, how to make it work. And hopefully in the next few years, I know it's slow.
So as we started interviewing people, we discovered this word called mom guilt, where people feel bad taking time for themselves to do other things. Do you ever feel dad guilt about like investing in yourself and your art when you should be like investing in your family more? Or do you feel like you have a good way of kind of separating yourself out and allotting time for yourself and your family?
Yes, I feel it, but it's more so like working too much. And that's actually one of, like, you know, the pros. The pandemic's been, you know, horrible in so many ways, but one of the pros has been being able to be home a lot more and home at night. Like, I would feel it more like I stopped teaching night classes, because even though there's a huge market for it, because people work and want to do things, but I also want to be home. Like, I wasn't home a lot of nights, even when I stopped doing those, because I'm charging or teaching a private lesson or something like that and not there for bedtime. So like, I feel those things. And then like, I do travel a little bit for shows. You feel a little guilty. Like if you're sitting in a hotel room, you know, or like out seeing live music, you feel guilty, but it's guilt, dad guilt, but it's also like guilt towards your spouse who's at home with the kids, and you're like, well, sorry, you know. But I don't do that very often. Like if there's a show or something, like I've been going out to Chicago the last few years for a week, and you know, it's a great time, but it's also rejuvenating. But my wife is incredibly supportive of everything that I do, so I have a very supportive partner, which is huge and helpful. But like, I don't really apply for residencies or things like that all that often, because I have kids and it's hard to pursue those things that I think would help further my career or, you know, be really fun and awesome. But it's not like guilt in that respect. I just know I can't do it. I'm just not doing it. You know, if I went and did it, yeah, I'd feel guilty, but I'm not. I did one residency because it was local at Salem State before they ended up closing that shop. And I would drive back and forth and I'd spend a couple nights there, which was awesome. And I got a lot done there, but I would love to do more.
Maybe as your family grows and you and your wife can be free to do it together.
Yes. Well, I do try to bring them. We all drove down to Florida this year. We are freaking out. You know, we had to leave. We took everything very seriously and no one went to school. We didn't do anything. I shut down teaching, like pretty much fully. I had 2 private students that I kept throughout the pandemic. But other than that, like I stopped teaching and I'm actually really not going back to it a whole lot. Just not there yet. But we all went down to Florida and we drove down and dropped work off at a gallery and took like a 4-day little trip down there, which was great. We rented a house, tried not to stay in hotels. And so if I can bring them more, I'm always trying to find a way to bring them. Like I would like to do more teaching in the summer, not teaching in my studio, but like go out Pendland. I know you can bring your kids there. things like that where I can bring my family and have them be part of it, because I think that's great to expose them to.
Well, thanks for answering that. I know it's a little personal.
Do you have any closing words or wisdom that you wanted to tell everybody who's listening?
A few things. I would say sell your work. You know, you can get complacent assisting people. It's great to assist people. It's great to learn that way. But along the way, sell your work, because you can make money selling what you make. Someone's going to love it. I would say try to pursue what you want to make if you can. You know, not fully, you know, you can dive into it fully if you can support yourself, but also like always make something that because you want to or you have to make this. Don't just get lost in production. Or production's great, there's nothing wrong with it, you know, but also try to pursue other ideas and think about what you want, how you want to be, if you're going to be a professional glass artist, where your place is, and chase that. But chase it slowly and calculated and figure it out like we all do.
Pursue your creativity.
Yes.
While making money.
Don't forget that part. Yeah, I think that's good advice, because you can get lost in the day-to-day grind. And it's nice when you're selling your stuff, because then you get feedback from people on what they like. And
yeah, and people are going to like what you make. Someone's going to love it.
Everyone's got a mom who's going to want your glass.
Yeah.
Right.
True.
Oh, thanks so much for your time and thought.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of Connected in Glass. Make sure to follow us on Facebook and Instagram for more information on the artists we interview and for updates on the podcast.